Route 616, your home for all Finn's Marvel main continuity. Hello, everybody. I'm here with Bill today.
How's it going?
And we're here for episode 52 of Route 616. Conspicuous by his absence is Dan, who's, he's the kind of guy whose best pick for a sports team is the Dallas fucking Stars, so, I mean, can we really trust him on here anyway? But,
I don't know if I would have gone that route. We're Leaf fans. We can't talk shit about the Stars.
Don't. You no need to bury us.
I mean, it's kind of on brand. I brought snacks to be on tune for the podcast. Jerky.
So today,
yes, I did go to the store and buy that just to make that joke.
Well. At least I already had my muffins. That's a reference from a few weeks back. Well, a few episodes back, if you haven't seen it.
That's a reference from last September.
Yeah, ultimately. So today we actually have some mostly good comics to cover, which is a nice change of pace.
I would say all good.
I wouldn't, but we'll talk about that soon.
Two of them aren't amazing, but there's not one here that I think is actually bad.
I don't know.
Actually, I'd say three of them aren't amazing.
But yeah, we got three X-Men's in a row to cover with issues 11, 12, and 13. Then we're going to do a Journey and Mystery annual. And then we'll have Fantastic Four number 38.
And for once, you don't have to be scared of three X-Men in a row, because this is one of the few bright parts in the initial X-Men run.
Yeah. You only have to be worried about the original one. But anyway. speaking of, let's talk about the original one. Who worked on this fucker? Of course, Stan Lee writing this bad boy, Jack Kirby on art. We've got Chick Stone on inks, Jack Kirby and Chick Stone on the cover, Artie Simic on letters. This is a March 1965 release date, 20-page story. And I'll be taking this one. I would like to say I do not agree with the average rating, as we'll discuss more as things go along.
I didn't remember agreeing with the average rating, but when I reread it for the podcast, I did.
So, Professor X calls the X-Men when his radar... By the way, buckle in, all these X-Men synopses take a while. But Professor X calls the X-Men when his radar image beam picks up the energy...
Are you going to tell people what this story's called?
The Triumph of Magneto is what it's called. I did indeed forget that.
Yeah, I know. You went straight into who wrote it and then the synopsis.
I'm totally not tired at all. I'm going to try to push through that for this podcast. Let's go. The energy signature of a very powerful being. However, before they can get a better analysis, the being suddenly disappears in a flash and explosion. Suspecting that this being of being a super powerful mutant, the Professor and Scott concern themselves with the potential of such a powerful being. Iceman and Beast, however, don't take this finding very seriously and begin horsing around again, prompting Marvel Girl to use her powers to break up the roughhousing. This leads to the Professor scolding Bobby for inciting the situation. Elsewhere in New York, the object of the X-Men's concern is a strange man in a suit that has taken up residence in a room and house. When the landlord comes by and demands a full week's rent in cash up front, the man pulls a large wad of money out of his coat and hands it to her. Deciding to explore the city, this man, the stranger, walks in the very air over the city to avoid traffic. This is what is see the Inhumans. The citizens of New York are shocked to find that there is a man walking right up in the sky. Not wishing to attract any more undue attention, the stranger flees the scene, but feels himself compelled to enter a particular building.
If you haven't noticed yet, this is a very 60s story.
It is. Probably why I didn't love it.
Yeah, I think I judged it kinder than you did because I kind of applied the standards of the time.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, the average rating is 3.2, so I'm the one that's off. Walking through the wall, the stranger finds Magneto and his Brotherhood of Evil Mutants inside, waiting for him. As the stranger meets the Brotherhood, the X-Men search the city for the supposed new mutant. As Angel scours the sky, the rest of the X-Men search the ground. Scott searches the streets and attracts the unwanted attention of the police. Well, he brings the attention to himself as he goes over to talk to the cops, and yeah, he like as he says something stupidly, and it starts the whole thing.
He didn't say something stupid. The cop demanded he took his sunglasses off, and they got into a scuffle over him not taking his sunglasses off. And the cop tried to take them off him.
Okay. I guess he just shouldn't have, I don't know.
The moral of the story is no good can come from talking to the police when you're a minority.
Yeah, sounds about right. I was intrigued that he just full-on went up to them and was like, hey, what's up, guys? What's going on? Type deal.
I don't
remember how it went.
Yeah, the anti-mutant stuff doesn't really become a thing until Claremont takes over in the late 70s.
Yeah.
They tease it once in a while and then immediately forget about it again.
In a scuffle, Scott's ruby quartz glasses are removed, causing his optic beam to fire wildly, smashing a fire hydrant in one of the officer's guns. Scott is then pulled out of the hairy situation by Beast and Iceman, who reunite him with Marrow Girl. The group then decides to continue looking for their quarry together. Oh my god, this is so long. Back in the building where the Stranger is met with the Brotherhood, the Stranger is offered membership with Magneto's team of evil mutants. When the Stranger asks why he should join up with Magneto's group, the Master of Magnetism gives the Stranger a show of power, with Magneto binding him with metal and Mastermind using his illusions. However, the Stranger sees through the illusions and breaks free of Magneto's binding. He decides to show his own power and fires a bolt of energy at Mastermind, which converts the illusion-casting mutant into solid matter. His weight increased, causing him to break through the floors of the building, alerting the store manager a floor below to call for help.
Okay, that's not the most clear. He literally makes him into a stone statue. He was already solid matter.
Yeah. We're all solid matter. That's okay. I honestly didn't remember that part. I just remembered the Stranger going through at one point. This alarm attracts the attention of the X-Men, who goes to investigate, and they find the Stranger with their mortal foes. Magneto orders Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch to attack the X-Men. Quicksilver strikes first, however, he is quickly stopped when Iceman coats him with ice. I wonder what else he'd be coating him with. Wanda then counterattacks with her hex bolts, which trips up both Beast and Iceman. Angel attempts to get close to the Stranger, but finds himself repelled by a magnetic barrier put up by Magneto. Growing tired, just like me reading the synopsis, the Stranger decides to leave, turning into Vortex to escape. Magneto wishes to go with him and is allowed, so he, followed by the ever-loyal Toad, enters the Vortex and it phases through the wall, eluding the X-Men. Cyclops and the others go to lend Iceman and Beast a helping hand, putting a stop to the Scarlet Witch's attack. Whew. Freeing Quicksilver from his frozen bond, the two Brotherhood members realize that they have been abandoned by Magneto. Cyclops offers them a chance to join the X-Men and help them stop Magneto. However, the two mutant siblings decline, having had enough of the constant conflict, and leave, vowing to one day return. Well, they do vow the one day return, but when they return, they vow to also be heroic and blah blah blah.
Someone's setting the stage for comics we're going to cover next week.
Yeah, they sure didn't take long to come back. But anyways, meanwhile,
I think this was actually released the same month as the first part of that Avengers arc.
Probably.
That's why they had to get them out of the Brotherhood.
They had to write them out real fast. Meanwhile, the Stranger has taken Magneto and Toad to a secluded spot, impressing Magneto with his abilities. The Stranger has a shock for Magneto, though, a twist, one might say. He reveals that he is not a mutant and that he intends to subjugate them with his power. Suddenly, the Stranger grows in size and envelops both Magneto and Toad in an anti-magnetic membrane. While at the X-Mansion, Professor X examines the transformed body of Mastermind and is shocked to find that he is alive, but his molecules have been transformed into the dense matter. Deciding that the Stranger is a potentially bigger menace than Magneto, the Professor gathers the X-Men and they fly out in their helicopter to find this being before he can act out again. The X-Men find the forest where the Stranger had taken Toad and Magneto and find the two evil mutants still bound. The Stranger then appears and reveals his true form, telling them that he is a stranger from beyond the stars. Telling the X-Men that he has developed an interest in human mutation, he teleports away with Magneto and Toad so that he might examine this phenomenon on his own world. The Stranger leaves the X-Men with the police arriving, prompting the outlaw heroes to flee the scene as quickly as possible. Later that day, Cyclops and Professor X are in the Professor's study where the Professor removes the place cards of Magneto, Toad, and Mastermind off the list of the mutants on Cerebro that might pose a threat. Suddenly, the Cerebro alarm goes off, warning the Professor and Cyclops of a coming threat that is headed right toward them.
Alright, so before we go into discussing this issue, there's something I want to correct from that synopsis. They don't flee to cops because they're wanted. They flee to cops because Xavier can't be seen with them because he's supposedly not affiliated with the X-Men.
Yes, that is, in fact, the case. They're not wanted yet. I mean, Cyclops got heat early in the issue. That's probably why they're confusing it, but that's not what's going
on. Yeah, because the cops are still a little pissed about the property damage, but even at the time, that cop is like, yeah, I was really stupid to just try to rip his sunglasses off. I should have known better.
Yeah. I didn't realize what happened with Mastermind in this issue the first time I read it, because I was really bored while reading this, so... I was wondering where he was at the end,
very important issue overall for the status quo of X-Men.
It is, because...
Magneto and Toad and Mastermind all out of the series here. At the time, they were intending, I think, all three of those to be permanent.
Probably.
Wanda and Pietro quit being evil.
Yeah,
so
that was...
it's basically a soft reboot of the X-Men franchise.
Yeah. And they come back swinging in these next two.
Yeah, so. And even this one, like, the first time I read it, I didn't really enjoy it, but I think I was just salty that I was getting another Brotherhood issue, and I didn't really think through what I was encountering, but I still gave it a 3, and rereading it, I definitely agree with that, because, yeah, it was another Brotherhood issue, but they rather conclusively said, look, we're not doing this anymore, we're going to start telling new stories.
Yeah. I forgot that the database kind of gives trivia, so I'm kind of looking at that. Apparently, this is the first issue that gives Professor X's full name of Charles Xavier, which I didn't really realize while reading, so that's kind of a cool, fun
fact.
Yeah,
I never picked that up either, because I just assumed that they had said it, because
we both know
him
so well and everything,
yeah.
So... we probably just didn't realize because we were like, oh, yeah, it's Charles Xavier.
Press yeah, exactly. You don't notice that they don't actually say it. It's more noticeable with something like Slim Summers, where it's actively different to what you expect.
This is the only Scott had known. Is this? Oh, I'm looking at 12. I'm not even looking at 11.
Yeah,
so that's next
rest
issue.
Of the X-Men don't learn about Cerebro until the next issue.
I'm friggin'...
Because originally Xavier just built Cerebro for Scott.
I wasn't even looking at 11. So the name Charles Xavier, that's in the next issue. I was reading that wrong. The only trivia on the number 11 was that the title was ironic. If you didn't know from the synopsis we just give you, the title is ironic. So.
Yeah. I mean, Magneto did get what he wanted.
Yeah.
He did get to go off and... affiliate himself with the Stranger.
Yeah, he sure did. Well, I gave that one a 2. I didn't really like that one. The stuff I liked out of that was Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver getting written out.
I liked that, and I liked Magneto getting his comeuppance. That's what brought it over a 3 for me.
I didn't really have any. I didn't feel any way about that, really. I don't know.
It's a storyline that even 5 years later would not have gotten a 3 because the ironic twist sci-fi story is falling out of vogue at this point. Because this is a very, 1958 Tales of Suspense style ending to its story. But I think for 64 it still works.
Yeah. Fair enough. On to issue 12, I suppose, of the X-Men. So, let's see. This one's titled The Origin of Professor X. Of course, written by Stan Lee. Jack Kirby's on the art with Alex Toth, apparently. Inks by Vincent Coletta. Cover arts by Jack Kirby and Frank Giacola. Sam Rosen's on letters here. This is a May 1965 release date. This is a 20-page story. Yeah. And Bill will take this one.
Jack did the layouts for this and then thought, penciled it. If you don't recognize the name, don't worry about it. This is literally his only credit. So, Cerebro is calling out an intruder alert, prompting the X-Men to don their uniforms. Okay, that's already wrong. They were stolen uniform because they just got back from fighting the Stranger. And come to the professor's study to learn who this mysterious intruder is. Telling his charges that whoever's approaching the mansion is extremely powerful, he sends the group out to set up defenses, including an ice wall, live wire line trench, and fence post rigged with grenades. When the X-Men return to the professor, they are shocked to learn that their attacker is none other than Xavier's own brother. The professor tells his X-Men that his father was a nuclear research scientist who was accidentally killed during a nuclear bomb test in the New Mexico desert. They need to stop testing fucking bombs in New Mexico. It always goes wrong. During his father's funeral, Kurt Marko, a fellow scientist, would come to comfort Xavier's mother. However, the young Charles knew of his less than noble intentions to take his mother and father's wealth and property, three things that Marko had become envious of. Shortly thereafter, Kurt moved into the Xavier mansion and married Charles' mother. Kurt became a ruthless and verbally abusive step-parent and shunned his new family for his work. During this time, Kurt's true motives would come out. One day, Kurt was thrown into a fury when his own son from a previous marriage, Kane, came to the Xavier mansion after yet another expulsion from school. Kane turned out to be a cruel tormentor to young Charles. The professor's narrative is interrupted when Kane's advancement on the mansion progresses, easily smashing through the ice wall put up by Iceman, much to the X-Men's surprise. Charles continues the story of his youth. He would explain that one day he overheard Kurt and Kane arguing over money. When told that he would not receive a handout, Kane suggested that Kurt had orchestrated the death of Charles' father, an accusation that Kurt would flatly deny. Charles entered and confronted them about the statement. During the moment of tension, Kane tried to throw chemicals at Charles. However, Kurt attempted to stop them, sending the volatile brew crashing to the floor, causing an explosion and fire. Kurt carried the two boys out of the blast. Having been mortally wounded in the blast, he begged Charles to believe that his father's death was only an accident before dying. Kane has reached the second barrier, the electromagnetic force field and live wire. As he is impeded by this barrier, Charles finishes the next part of his story. He explains that by his adulthood, he found that his mental powers, which by this point had rendered him bald, could allow him to have an advantage over other students academically and in sport. However, he decides against using it for personal gain. His trophy winnings earned the ire of Kane, who pushed Charles too far one day, and the two got into a fight. Charles won the fight due to his mental ability to read his mind and know his movements. Some days later, Kane attempted to make Charles cry out in fear by driving recklessly. He only succeeded in making the car drive out of control and smash through a detour sign and down a cliff. Kane bailed out, but Charles wasn't so lucky. However, Charles would tell his X-Men that he was able to erect a mental shield around himself to protect himself from the crash. In other words, Jack tried to retcon the stupid Lucifer thing, and Stan's just like, no, fuck you. We're doing Lucifer.
Stan's an asshole.
Yes, he should have had this be what paralyzed Charles.
He should have. He should have, and I think they do retcon it to be that later, so it's like, what the fuck?
Nope. As of at least 2021, which is the last time I've checked, the official cause of Xavier's paralysis is still Lucifer.
Wow. That's crazy.
That is one of the things that has never been retconned in Marvel. It was probably the Ultimate X-Men that you're thinking of. I bet they did it there.
I don't know. I think maybe others have tried to, but they didn't keep it either. I don't know. Because the stepbrother Finn also gets erased later on, too. So.
Yeah.
They play around with the Juggernaut's origin a lot.
Yeah. It's kind of too bad, because his origin here is actually really good.
I think, it is. It's great.
Outside the mansion, Kane finishes with the live wire and breaks through the force barrier. He then makes it to the grenade traps and gas traps that were set out for him. He staggers through the gas traps, and Iceman puts an ice barrier over the busted window of Xavier's study so no gas comes in. The gas was in the grenades because comic code. This allows the professor to tell the final part of his story. Kane and Charles had grown and were enlisted in the military and had been sent to fight in the Korean War. Kane deserted while under fire and sought refuge in a cave. Charles rushed after him, and they had stumbled into the long-lost Temple of Sithorak. You might recognize that word from Doctor Strange. The greedy Kane grabbed the crimson gem that was left before an altar. Upon contact and reading an inscription, the gem transformed Kane into a hulking form. The cave began to collapse because it was bombed from the outside. Charles escaped the cave while Kane was buried under tons of rock. Finishing his story, Charles realizes that Kane has finally dug himself out from the cave and sought out his brother for revenge. With the last of the outer defenses, the X-Men sealed the mansion's front door with a near impervious steel plate and waited for Kane's next move. Much to the X-Men's surprise, Kane is able to smash through the supposedly indestructible steel door and easily knocks the X-Men aside. Revealing himself for the first time in years, Charles looks at his brother, garbed in a special mystical armor, and calls him a human juggernaut. And that's how this story ends.
Woohoo! This one was really good. It kind of sucks that... Unless they've retconned it to be the case again, last I checked, I'm pretty sure that it's still retconned out now that they aren't stepbrothers, but I like them more when it's that the stepbrothers. Or maybe I'm confusing... I might also be confusing them with what they did with Wolverine and Sabretooth in the Origins movie, but I think they did retcon it unless they brought it back, which would be good, because I think this works well here. Kurt, the stepfather, his arc is a little bit silly. It's like he's so hateful, and they build it up like it's gonna be revealed that he did kill Xavier's father, and it's like, I actually did, and I was just a coward and didn't save him. And he's like, actually, Xavier, watch out for yourself. Charles, watch out for yourself.
I actually liked that. Because they always are responsible for the accident. Every time you get an asshole stepfather like this, they're responsible for the death of the real father.
Yes.
So I thought it was a nice subversion that this time it's like, no, Kurt's an asshole, but he's not a murderer.
Yeah, but I think it would have worked better if he wasn't, like, literally an asshole in every other aspect, including to the woman he married and actively taken Charles' father's everything. I don't know. It just, something didn't click there for me. I mean, I guess it's the right before death redemption thing, but it's like,
I don't
whatever.
Think it was necessary for him to be an asshole because we have Kane for that role.
Yeah.
Like, he could have just been a completely fine guy, and then Kane's a little bastard, but he can't do anything about it.
Yeah. I don't know, but that's one little nitpick. I mean, I gave this one a 4, is what I gave it.
I gave it a 4 as well. My nitpick was the fact that you've got the fucking juggernaut attacking the school, and Xavier knows how dangerous he is, and he's just like, wait, wait, I gotta tell you guys this story.
Yeah, the frame of the face is really fucking stupid, too. That's my other thing.
Yeah. That's what kept it from being a 5 for me, is the fact that Xavier, the one person who knows it, and then he has them set up all these traps just so he has time to tell them a story. Like, yeah. You know, kick Juggernaut's ass, then tell them the story. Yeah. It works better for the pacing of the comic to get the story first, but...
Professor, what's happening? Oh, just... You'll understand what's going on. Let me just tell you this story. Like, fuck off.
Yeah, just be like, hey, this is a guy that's, like, impervious to everything.
And we already talked about Lucifer part, but I love how, in the story, Cyclops is like, oh, Professor, is that how you got paralyzed? And Charles is like, nah, that was something with Lucifer. I turned out all right from that bad car accident.
Yeah, you know that was just a direct shot at Jack, because Jack drew that scene to give a new explanation for,
I read that and I was like, motherfucker.
Yeah, that was a direct shot at Jack.
Yeah, it definitely was. Oh, shit. That was just a really good issue of X. Probably my favorite issue of X-Men so far, to be honest.
I think that is, if not my favorite, close to my favorite from the entire pre-cancellation run of X-Men.
Nice.
The only other arcs that come close to this one are the first appearance of the Sentinels and the stuff with Polaris and Havoc right at the end. They do some good stuff.
Nice. Well, moving on to issue 13 for some more Juggernaut action. This one's titled Where Walks the Juggernaut, a classic story title. Stan Lee writing
Stan
this one.
Stan does like that phrase. Either that one or the coming of blank. Or, the gentleman's name is blank. He loves those three titles.
Yeah. This one's, the art's done by Jack Kirby and Warner Roth under his pen name of J. Garvin. Under his pseudonym, I mean.
Yeah, the Warner Roth X-Men are fantastic. The art on them.
Yeah, and that was a trivia note that I was going to get to in our database, but it actually says that on our site, so I figured I'd point it out now. Inks are done by Joe Snow. Cover is done by Jack and Joe. And letters are done by Sam Rosen. This is a July 1965 release date, a 20-page story. And I will take this one. If I scroll back up to the start of the synopsis, there we go. The Juggernaut, Charles Xavier's mystically enhanced stepbrother, has finally returned home to once more renew his rivalry with his brother. Charles attempts to protect himself of his fast mental powers, but finds to his shock and surprise that Kane's helmet protects him from mental attacks. The X-Men, he says that he had been trying to from the start, so he knew something was up, but anyways. The X-Men revive, and with Marvel Girl's telekinetic power lifting up the Juggernaut, Cyclops blasts the floor out from under the foe, causing him to crash into the ground below, giving the X-Men time to retreat back and try to come up with a means of defeating their attacker. Xavier takes the X-Men to the lab, and Professor builds a device that allows him to amplify his mental projections and sends out a thought wave into the city to seek allies in defeating the Juggernaut. Meanwhile, Cyclops and Angel go back to where they last saw the Juggernaut, attempting to keep him at bay using Cyclops' optic blast. However, the Juggernaut smashes his way around the two X-Men and gets the drop on them. Neither Angel's fists nor Cyclops' optic blasts are capable of stopping their enemy. I also do love how Angel is actively punching Juggernaut, but not complaining that like his hands are broken in this. That's kind
of
funny to me.
Yeah, it's one of the few times Angel is useful. and I don't mean that directly as a dig at Angel. It's just no one fucking writes him useful. Not in X-Men, and not in Champions later. X-Men's or Angel's like the most useless one there, too.
Yeah, Angel doesn't get his rightful push until he becomes Archangel, really.
Yeah, because no one knew how to make Angel, like, useful, because his power is flying, and they're not creative enough to do anything with that, so he's just a guy who flies around and, like, is in scenes to be like, oh, look, there's a flying guy.
Not only can he just fly, which is a born power set anyways by itself, Because
half the superheroes can fly.
He's also just he's also a rich white boy, so he has everything going against.
It works for Bruce Wayne, but he's not Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. Oh shit, buddy, we need you to be traumatized because you've been secretly clipping your wings in the bathroom to hide it from your father. Like, come on. But anyway, fuck. Oh, gotta love X2. No, that was Last Stand. I take that back. That was Last Stand. He was half that movie.
I actually really liked that scene. That was like one of the most disturbing things I've seen in a superhero movie.
The Angel is actually one of the better parts of that whole movie.
Which is one of the rare times that Angel's the better part of anything.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why I shouted it out. But anyway.
So anyway, resuming today's episode of Why Angel Sucks.
Fuck. Xavier takes the X-Men to the lab, that's the one I already just read. Jesus Christ, me. Back in the lab, the professor manages to contact both Rick Jones' teen brigade. I was so angry when I saw that at first. And,
now are you getting it?
Now I'm feeling the same heat with Rick Jones, the teen brigade that Bill's had the whole time. And then the professor also tries to contact Matt Murdock, who is secretly the hero Daredevil, of course. He doesn't try to contact Matt Murdock. He tries to contact Daredevil. The professor probably knows he's Matt Murdock if he can read minds, but, like, it's not expressly stated. But anyway...
Yeah, but Matt's in court, so...
No, Daredevil was going through the streets. This is when he's chasing... Is this not when he's chasing the, who he's facing in the next issue, Namor? Or is that the...
No, I think you're thinking of Johnny, because he gets Johnny out in the streets. Matt's in court, hears Professor Xavier and gets all distracted has to, like, focus back in on his court case.
This is when he's in court. I'm thinking of, because they reference him in the, they've referenced him in Thor or something after the Daredevil
he turns
issue.
Up... I think it's in Thor that he shows up again because
because he's chasing Namor from
which
is what happens.
Because you were
issue.
Asking me why that Thor issue was after Avengers and
Daredevil,
and it was because of those scenes.
Yeah, because fucking they keep making Daredevil cameos. Which, by the way, this little cameo by Matt Murdock, who's Daredevil, is his only appearance in the X-Men title until issue 351.
I was so happy he didn't drop everything and run out of court, though. Because 90% of the time, that's what they'd have him do.
This is also where they messed up the coloring and had Matt be blonde.
Yeah.
Now that I'm remembering the court scene. However, neither can come to the X-Men's aid. That's the team brigader, Matt Murdock. The Teen Brigade can't send the Avengers because that's who they tried to get.
I would argue that the Teen Brigade not showing up did aid the X-Men. It would have gone so much worse if they were worried about tripping over a bunch of kids.
To stall for time, the professor sends Beast and Iceman to go help Cyclops and Angel, who are having a hard time keeping the Juggernaut back. As Iceman and Beast join the fray, Charles attempts to get the aid of the Fantastic Four's Johnny Storm, a.k.a. the Human Torch, who is out testing a new modified car with some of his classmates. Hearing the professor's mental call for help, Johnny assumes that it might be one of Fantastic Four's many villains and dismisses it. Although he is trapped in an ice block, the Juggernaut manages to break free and battles the Beast in hand-to-hand combat. The Beast only succeeds in getting his foot injured, however... But this does not stop the brainy mutant, who lures the Juggernaut into the danger room and activates all of its traps in the hopes that it can defeat its seemingly unstoppable foe.
That was actually pretty badass. Beast would have broken leg, like, dragging himself into the danger room to use the controls.
No, Beast was actually really good here. The Juggernaut survives the traps and then knocks the Beast out when he throws back a rolling cylinder. By the time the professor has finally managed to convince the Human Torch to come to the X-Men's rescue and then goes with Marvel Girl to help the others, Jean keeps the Juggernaut off balance by lifting him in the air with her telekinetic powers until the Torch arrives. Johnny uses his flame powers to blind the Juggernaut and commands the Five, an angel to remove the helmet from the Juggernaut's head that Beast had loosened earlier in battle. Without his protective helmet, the Juggernaut is easily struck down by the Professor's mental powers. With the battle over, Professor thanks Johnny for his help. He wishes that the secret of the X-Men's headquarters remain a mystery and erases the memory from Johnny's mind and sends him on his way. Later, the male members of the X-Men are sent to the bed to recover from the injuries they sustained battling the Juggernaut, with Jean acting as their nurse. Much to the pleasure of the X-Men, proud of his X-Men, the Professor tells him that he has an award for them when they are once more able to get up and about, but he jokes that it's just cleaning.
This shows how much of a dick Xavier is. Johnny fucking comes and helps him. And he's like, yeah, erase your memory.
Yeah, I hate that trope. It's
fuck you. Enough.
I think that's one of the reasons I rated this one less than the last. Well, the whole ending stretch is kind of dumb. Nurse Jean.
That's
the
just
boy.
60s sexism it's, jokes.
It
though.
Is 60s sexism, but
I didn't
680
dock
being
it.
A dick.
I didn't dock it for that because I'm trying to rate them on the standards of the time they appeared in. And so docking a comic in the 60s for making a sexist joke seems kind of unfair, because...
No, it was just the whole London stretch combined for me. I didn't really do it for that specific instance. And I didn't really like Xavier trying to get all the help that he was getting there. That was just more lame cameo baiting for maybe bringing attention to titles and stuff. But I don't know. I don't know. This one didn't hit as well for me as the last one did. Some of the battle stuff with Juggernaut was cool by itself, but Beast stuff was cool. Angel was useful. I don't know.
This one worked for me. I still gave it 4.
This was the Human Torch's first appearance in X-Men, if anybody was curious. Because
I'm actually amazed
so
they had such a great restraint that he hasn't shown up again all the way up to where I'm reading.
Wow.
Because they stick Torch in everything.
Oh, yeah. Another fun trivia fact is, which actually was still left in the Marvel Unlimited version that I read, because I noticed it reading myself, is when Johnny makes reference that he can't help at first, he doesn't want to help because he's getting ready for Reed and Sue's wedding. And there's an editorial note made that they say it's happening in Fantastic Four Annual number 4 instead of number 3.
Yeah,
I
didn't catch that error because I don't really pay much attention to the
you
editorial
don't read
notes.
The editor's note? What the fuck, Bill?
I read it, but I don't really pay attention to the number. I'm like, oh yeah, they're talking about the annual.
Oh, I noticed it. I was going to bring it up anyways if the trivia didn't, but...
I read so many of these that I barely pay attention to what number stuff is.
I'm more neurotic like that, I guess.
Yeah, I know a couple of the big numbers, like Amazing Spider-Man 121. But for the most part, I don't really pay attention to what number anything is. I look it up long enough. I don't even do that now that I got my Marvel Unlimited subscription back. I used to look it up enough to look up the comic, but now I don't even have to do that. I just click the Read Online button.
Fair enough. Well, I guess we already gave a rating, so we might as well move right forward.
Yeah, we already talked about most of the major points I had, like Angel actually being useful, Beast being a badass.
I guess I will say that the next issue we're teased to be getting the Sentinels, so...
Oh, yeah,
stay tuned.
It's another excellent arc. At this point, it looked like X-Men was suddenly going to be great.
Well, they come back swinging, like I said.
Yeah, but then it falls off again as soon as the
and
Sentinels are over.
Keep in mind that at this point, too, X-Men's a bi-monthly title, so it's only every second month.
Yeah.
Should they have a little more time to work with on this bad boy?
I think that's what does it in. They go back to being monthly, and all of a sudden the stories are terrible again.
So, let's move on to Journey into Mystery Annual, number 1, which is the only one that exists, but, you know. This one's titled When Titans Clash. We're only going to be reading the first story because it's the only new one, but the story is about Thor versus Hercules. They had a bunch of backup stories.
Yeah, they retold Loki and the Emissaries of Evil, the Radioactive Man,
it was all first appearances.
Duplicator, and the Lava Man. So they picked some real winners.
Yeah. AKA, all of them were, like, pretty bad besides the Loki story.
Yeah, the Loki one.
The Lava
one
Man
was
one
decent.
Was actually okay, but the Lava Man's just
Lava
not an important
Man.
Character.
Yeah, I liked the Lava Man.
We
that
both
was a
did.
Fun one.
I was fucking... I had heat for a second and was fucking... I was offended that they dared to reprint the Demon Duplicator story, though.
Oh, God, that one was so bad.
I can't believe they fucking put that in this shit. They also have a Tales of Asgard in the back, too, or whatever. The first one does, or something.
Yeah, they actually thought people were going to buy this book. For the Demon Duplicator. Or not this book, but they're going to, like, read Demon Duplicators and start buying Journey.
Yeah, why? Who had that idea? That was... like, what the fuck? I couldn't believe that. Like, what? Out of all the stories you have. But anyways...
And, I mean, spoilers. Even this story isn't exactly a strong selling point. It's your typical annual, completely pointless story.
Yeah.
I like this one.
Me too.
But you're not worse off for not having read it.
No. I mean, you'll miss the first appearance of Hercules, but that's not really a huge selling point either, considering.
Yeah, and at the point this was written, they had no intention of Hercules being a recurring character.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious by how things are left in the movement.
Yeah. Anyway.
Written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, inks by Vincent Coletta. Cover art by Jack Kirby. Letters by Sam Harrison. July 1965 release date, which means it's actually dated after some of the Thor issues that are coming up, which is why I was thrown off by the dates at one point. And this is a 15-page story.
Yeah, well, we've got like a year-long arc in Thor.
Yeah, I know. I just realized that was the case, though, because I was looking at the dates yesterday or something. I was like, oh, what the hell? But anyways, Bill's going to take this one away.
While traveling out to Jotunheim, Thor and Loki are searching for a path leading to the land of Olympus, home of the Olympian gods, when they happen on some frost giants, which Thor easily defeats in combat. That should have been multiple sentences. However, the battle causes the ground to rupture, and Thor falls into the chasm and finds himself in a tunnel. Following to its end, he finds himself on Olympus. Because, naturally, going underground is the way to get to a mountain. After exploring a bit, he seeks to cross a bridge, but is halted by Hercules, who demands that no one cross the bridge until he has done so. Finding such a notion ridiculous, as there is room for boatmen to cross the bridge... Okay, there's a word missing. That's why I was completely lost there. Thor ignores the demand and begins crossing the bridge. It just says, ignores the demand and begins crossing the bridge, which completely threw me off. This leads to the arrogant Hercules to begin attacking Thor, who seeks to match his strength and his weapon, a club, against Thor's hammer. Thor attempts to toss his hammer at Hercules, but finds the demigod able to grab it in mid-flight and toss it back to Thor. Before you start thinking this means Hercules is worthy... That enchantment hasn't been added yet. At this point, it's just really fucking heavy. The battle wages on. As boat combatants match each other's attacks, it becomes... I'm going to stop trying to read this and just parse it myself.
Is it... I didn't preview
that one.
I'm
pretty sure whoever wrote this one... English is their second language. So they fight, but they're evenly matched. With no end to the battle in sight, they are stopped when they are struck by Zeus, ruler of the Olympian gods. With Zeus calling the battle to an end, the two strong men bow in honor of the request. Thor explains that he had come on a mission of peace, and both he and Hercules make it clear or declare each other friends before Zeus uses his power to return Thor to Jotunheim. In Jotunheim, Thor finds Loki inspecting the damage done during Thor's battle with the Frost Giants. When Thor questions where Loki was during the battle, the god of mischief claims that he fled the battle to search for aid. Thor does not believe him. Suddenly, before anything else can be said, the cavern to Olympus is filled with rock and a mountain is constructed in its place, forcing the two gods to seek cover. With the way to Olympus sealed, they decide to leave. However, Thor begins to wonder when, if ever, he may meet Hercules again. This was just a fight. It's a fight. There was some flimsy framing to explain why the fight happened. But literally this happened because people wrote letters and were like, hey, why doesn't Thor ever fight any other gods?
Yeah, which Stan references at the start of the first issue.
Yeah, he admits this is just because people were asking about it.
Saying all that, though, I mean...
I gave this three. I enjoyed this.
I'm easy to please. I gave it four. I'm above the average by a star, but I really liked it. It's brief and easy read. It's a fun read. Getting Hercules. Good stuff. Yeah.
I probably would have if I ever gave fight issues fours, but if it's just going to be a fight with nothing else happening, can't really get higher than a three because, like I said at the start, you could not read this and it hurts your enjoyment of the ongoing continuity of Marvel, not at all. And I know this for a fact because the first time I read through here, this wasn't on Marvel Unlimited and it wasn't available in any bootleg forms. So I didn't read it until it was reprinted in, like, 1975. So, about a year later in my reading, and I never missed it. I never felt like I didn't know what was going on. There was no context to anything missing. This is literally just a fight for the sake of having a fight.
Fair enough. Anyways, let's get on to our main event for the week as we enter the land of Fantastic Four with issue number 38. And this one is titled Defeated by the Frightful Four, so yes, they're back. Stan Lee's written this one, art by Jack Kirby. Inks by Chick Stone, cover art by Jack Kirby. Sam Rosen's on letters for this one. This is a March 1965 release date, a 20-page story, and I will be taking Fantastic Four for once. This is my show now. We just decided to go back and forth today, so.
Doesn't bother me any. I don't have any strong attachment to covering one title over another.
True. I just like giving you this one normally, but that's just personal preference. Reed, Ben, and Johnny are busy looking over enlarged photographs of the Skrull Galaxy for research when suddenly they are interrupted by Sue, who playfully reminds them that there are wedding plans to go over. Although she is invisible to the eye, they manage to grab her and make her give up with her pranking. With the merriment over, Johnny decides to head off to go on a date with his girlfriend, Dora Sevens.
Speaking of 67 sexism... There is a joke here about Ben spanking Sue.
Yep. But I was just going to move past that. But anyway. as he flies away from Baxter Building, he just misses the wizard who is passing by. The foe then goes to land at the secluded cabin where the Frightful Four are hiding new. There he is attacked by the Sandman, but is repelled by the wizard's anti-gravity devices. Pastepot Pete, having now renamed himself the Trapster, boo.
Worst decision ever.
Boo. Lunges in to test out his new paste-based traps. After they succeed in subduing the wizard, he shows his supremacy by throwing the Frightful Four around with his anti-gravity weapons.
I mean, we all know that what really happened was he got excited seeing Madame Medusa.
Oh shit. Soon they launch their next plot against the Fantastic Four. It begins with Medusa confronting the Invisible Girl while she is out picking dress designs for her wedding. Caught off guard, Sue is easily captured and the news of her kidnapping quickly spreads. When the Thane learns what happened, he rushes back to the Baxter Building to tell Reed and Johnny what he has learned, only to find that Reed is already busy trying to track the Frightful Four down. Meanwhile, the Frightful Four have landed their ship on a former nuclear testing site on an atoll in the South Pacific. There, the wizard shows his comrades and prisoners his greatest invention yet, the Q-Bomb, which he intends to use against the Fantastic Four. Back at the Baxter building, the FF are desperately trying to locate Sue when suddenly the Raiders pick up a ship flying their way. They attack it, but only succeed in getting Johnny captured by the Frightful Four as well. As their foes flee, Reed and Ben follow after them in the pogo plane. The Fantastic Four are caught off guard when they land on the atoll and their enemies attack. Although they soon start getting the upper hand, the Frightful Four flee, leaving the heroes to go off and rescue Sue. However, with the pogo plane having been destroyed in the flight, they have no way off the island. As the Frightful Four speed away, the wizard sets the bomb to explode. But unknown to him, the Fantastic Four are thrown clear from the atomic blast thanks to a force field put around them by Sue. Knocked unconscious by the blast, the four are lost at sea as the Fiend slowly begins to revert back to human form.
Hope Ta-da. You like cliffhangers.
This was actually a really good cliffhanger that made me want to read the next Fantastic Four, but we won't be getting that for a while, it seems. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that they need to get into position for appearances in the next Fantastic Four. I think it's specifically Daredevil that needs to have a bunch of stuff happen before he can appear in the next Fantastic
Four. You're telling me we're about to go on a Daredevil stretch? That's...
I don't think there's a Daredevil stretch.
It's he just needs to fit in all his cameos?
It's more cameos in his book, I think. I don't remember exactly. I know it's Daredevil that is the issue, because the next issue is... Actually, I think the next part of the story might be in a Daredevil story.
Interesting.
It's definitely a Daredevil-focused issue. Yeah, it's a Daredevil-focused issue. Oh, that's the other problem. In Journey into Mystery 123, it's believed the Fantastic Four are dead. So that's why we have the huge clump of Thor in there.
Well, the Frightful Four cameoed in a Thor issue I already read, and it was them talking about... Oh, because they thought that they got tricked into thinking that they made it back somehow because they saw fire coming out from the top of the Baxter building, but it's when Balder appears on Earth.
Yeah, because they're believed to be dead at that point.
Yeah, well, they don't say that yet, but that's when because in here, in this story, it's just that the Frightful Four think they're fucking dead because they don't see the Fantastic Four get thrown and they explode the bomb. So then they appear in four, and then it's like, oh shit, they somehow made it back because there's fire shooting from the building, but
yeah,
it's not
them.
Yeah,
and in the next issue of Fantastic Four, the Frightful Four realize 100% no, they are alive.
Yeah, and so then it must
be... So we
be...
have to get that whole Thor in there because that has to happen while the Frightful Four believe they're dead.
Yeah, so then...
So that's why we have the huge hunk of Thor, and then we also need to get Daredevil into position for the next issue.
But yeah, that was Fantastic Four 38. I'm just kind of scrolling through to see if there was any interesting notes. I'm not going to read that first one because, well... maybe I will. Prior to the story, the Frightful Four were pulled forward in time by Aaron the Rogue Watcher to battle the Fantastic Four, which takes place in Fantastic Four number 400. So, there's kind of a bit of a... They play with time a little bit in the future when they were... from their last appearance to this one. Is that one interested? No, that one's not interested. They mentioned the wedding happening in the next annual.
I like how much they've been tying the wedding into this entire year of Fantastic Four.
Yeah, it's been good. It's a good, great thing to do. It building up to it. Johnny's been dating Doris Evans since Strange Tales number 113, in case you haven't been reading that, which wouldn't blame you.
Although I suspect this is the last appearance of Doris. I've been anticipating it for a while. But I know pretty much at the same time Johnny's solo book disappears, Doris, like, it's just mentioned in the Fantastic Four that they broke up off panel and she's never seen again.
That's hilarious. She finally pulled the trigger, but it was off panel. Now, Baseball Pete renames himself to the Trapster in this issue, but he never lives down his old name and is repeatedly mocked for it hereafter. He sure is.
I mark out every time they call him Pisspot Pete.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It's a dumb name, but he's a dumb villain.
I won't read that one because that's a comic that's coming up too soon to really talk about. And there's what I was talking about. The Frightful Four make a stop the Baxter Bill in the Journey in Mystery 116 to make sure the Fantastic Four were killed in the blast, but are frightened off by the arrival of Balder the Brave on the rooftop of the building.
Yeah, and then 123, they're still believed to be dead.
Yeah, so in between 116 and that 123 is when they think they're dead at some point.
Yeah, so...
Probably in 123, really.
I don't remember the context where it's referred to. The Fantastic Four being dead in 123, it might not actually be a Frightful Four thing. It might just be like the Avengers or something think they're dead.
Yeah.
But they're definitely considered dead in 123. So that's why we have so much Thor and stuff in before we get the second half of that cliffhanger.
Interesting. Well, that was this week's episode. Before we go, we'll tell you what we're going to cover next week, and I'll do all the normal clothes and jazz. So, next week, we will be starting off with a couple of Avengers issues, with Avengers number 15 kicking us off, and this will be the Avengers versus their catalog of villains that they've faced so far. Then we will get Avengers number 16, which sees the old order change and some new heroes join the Avengers.
That's fine. One of the most important Avengers issues, probably since 4.
Yep. And then we'll get a Daredevil issue with number 7, where he faces off against Namor, which is the best Daredevil issue so far.
I put 1 higher.
Also, not the only important thing that happens in that issue, as Daredevil gets his new classic/iconic red costume.
The one that actually made him have staying power.
Yeah.
That red costume carried him through like 20 years of bad comics. Because Daredevil isn't really consistently good until Frank Miller in the 80s.
Yeah. Then we'll start off a huge stretch of Journey in the Mystery with a few stories from it next time, which starts with issue 114 of Journey in the Mystery, which is the first appearance of the Absorbing Man. And then the battle continues with the Absorbing Man in issue number 115, with that battle happening and Loki scheming even more. And then we get the issue we just teased a little bit about to end this off next week, which will be issue 116, which is the Trial of the Gods.
That's one of my favorite ones of that arc.
Me too. It's actually my favorite so far that I've read.
I think the end of the arc might rate higher for me, but it was up there.
But yeah, so a pretty dang good stretch next week. Actually, we're just on a really good stretch right now for at least a few weeks. So
I've been saying 1965 cool. is one of my favorite years of the Order.
Yeah, it's probably the best year so far for sure. That we're getting some good stuff here. So yeah, stay tuned for that next week. Maybe we'll have Dan back, maybe we won't. Either way, stay tuned, and stay tuned also for some more TEW action, as when we're recording this, it'll be tomorrow when we do some TEW action, but these could be uploaded the same day. So
this is going to require some editing, probably, so it might be a little slower.
Yes, we'll see what happens there.
We're going to try some post-production content.
Yeah, the thing is, we're going to start a new TEW series. We're going to start a co-op run where Bill and I are both booking our own companies, and it's going to be a modern run. I'm going to be controlling WWE, Bill's going to be controlling AEW. So stay tuned, because it's going to be interesting.
I got AEW on the basis of basically not knowing WWE's undercard, because I haven't watched their product in 6 years.
Yeah, I know the roster and Bill doesn't, so that's why
you at least read Twitter and stuff, so you know who guys like Rick Boogs are.
Yeah, oh, I sure know who Rick Boogs is.
I've seen the name. That's literally all I know about him.
Oh, Bill, get ready to go on the Boogs Cruise, buddy.
I've heard he's good. I don't know. I've never seen him.
He's entertaining, is what I would say.
This is WWE. That is good.
Yeah. And sometimes it's cringeworthy entertainment, but it's whatever. So, stay tuned for the TEW and stay tuned for next week's episode of Route 616. If you're watching this on YouTube, please leave a like, subscribe, comment, even share if you'd like to. We're also available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. And if you're listening to this on Spotify, let us know why The Stranger is your favorite X-Men villain. Bill and I now
fuck
have
the
to
Stranger. I have an irrational hatred for the Stranger. The stories he shows up in aren't even that bad. I just hate him.
It's just a lame gimmick. He's not even that bad to read.
He's the worst of the Celestials, or whatever the fuck they call those, because he's like the same thing as the Taskmaster and the Collector, and so he's one of those things.
Oh yeah, that's Celestials, I think.
I thought so, but then there's also Celestials and Eternals, and that threw me off if I was having the right word.
They fuck around with Celestials a lot, so I wouldn't worry about it too much.
I mean, I'm not worried about anything, because it's very obvious that Eternals isn't supposed to be 616 at this point.
Interesting.
Jack's rewritten the entire origin story of humanity and stuff, contrary to what's already been established in 616 canon, so, early Eternals is going to take a lot of retconning to make it fit into 616.
I guess they probably do it at some point. Anyways, let's actually wrap up the episode like we were. We will see you all next time, and peace out.
Have a good one, everyone.